Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Coming up in the program, a former opponent of Congresswoman Liz Cheney explains why some Republicans in the state are furious with Cheney for voting to impeach former President Donald Trump.
In many ways, she undermined the principles of the people that put her in office.
After a pretty dismal response to get the COVID-19 vaccine from Wyoming healthcare providers, the next priority group wants the vaccine badly.
How long can you roll the dice at over 70 years of age and hope that you don't get COVID?
And we will bring you three stories about policing in the Mountain West and hear from former officers about ways to make their profession better.
This focus on bad apples is misguided when we look at how to really improve the profession.
Those stories and more are coming up next on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. It's been an interesting time for U.S. Representative Liz Cheney. After handily winning re-election in November, she voted to impeach former President Donald Trump this month and has faced a strong backlash. Cheney has been censured by the Carbon County Republican Party and is likely to be censured by the Republican Central Committee of the state next month, and already has primary opponents for 2022, a list that includes State Senator Anthony Bouchard of Cheyenne. One person that faced off against her the first time she ran is former Laramie County Republican Chairman Darren Smith. Smith actually attended the rally in Washington, D.C., protesting the acceptance of the voting results, when he was shocked to see the riots occur. But he was more shocked that Congresswoman Cheney's reaction was to vote to impeach President Trump. Liz Cheney, because of the riots, decides to be part of the impeachment of the president. When you first heard about that, what were your thoughts?
Here's my thought on that. Liz Cheney put her personal family feud with the president ahead of the Constitution and ahead of the Wyoming people. She voted to impeach the president without giving him his due process.
So when you say family feud, would you discuss that?
I think that it's clear that that the Cheney family is upset with the president because he has criticized her father for his policies in the Middle East, which resulted in the loss of trillions of dollars to the U.S. and thousands of servicemen, whatever side you take, thousands of servicemen's lives, American lives have been lost. And I know that that is a feud between Donald Trump and Liz Cheney.
Smith points out he never heard President Trump tell people to storm the Capitol, which is the rationale that Cheney used for her impeachment vote. So in his view, Cheney voted to impeach the president without evidence.
I know that Liz Cheney said that she's not going anywhere, but I don't think that, first of all, she's not from Wyoming. She's never been from Wyoming since she moved away when she was in junior high. And I told Liz, I said, Liz, as long as your walk matches your talk, I told her this in 2016, I'm going to support you. I'm going to be a fan. I'm going to have your back. And that has changed for me significantly since she has not been willing to support the president and not been willing to support many of us in Wyoming who just won an audited election. So I think that it's much bigger than what she thinks. And I don't think that in 18 months from now, I don't think that people are going to forget and roll over and say, oh, that was no big deal. In many ways, she undermined the principles of the people that put her in office.
Smith says the reaction against Cheney has been strong, and he doubts people will forgive and forget, and he fully expects the Republican Central Committee to censure Cheney themselves. Smith also doubts it will make any difference if Cheney fights against the new administration and Democratic policies very hard over the next couple of years. He fully expects someone to run against Cheney in the upcoming Republican primary. Darren, I know Senator Bouchard mentioned that he was interested in running for this seat. You did very well against her when you ran for office against her the very first time. How much are you thinking about this?
Bob, that is a great question. And I'll tell you that dozens and dozens of people have contacted me, and my wife and I, we're discussing it. We're discussing it with our closest family and friends, and we are considering it strongly.
Do you think the amount of money it would take to run against her and run a successful campaign will scare people off again in 2 years?
You know what? I don't. I think that that already we have people that are jumping in that probably have no chance of beating Liz. I don't think that's going to scare folks off. But I do think that if I jump in, it'll be a two-person race. It'll be myself against Liz, and then the rest of the field will fade away.
Darren Smith is the former chairman of the Laramie County Republican Party and was one of the many opponents of Liz Cheney when she first sought office in 2016. Now let's turn our attention to COVID-19, especially the vaccines. Many Wyoming healthcare providers and people who are exposed regularly to COVID-19 were not all that interested in a COVID-19 vaccine. But it turns out the next priority group, which includes people over the age of 70, want it. And the supply is not matching the demand. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska has more.
Susie Scott hasn't been able to volunteer or see her children without a mask for longer than 5 minutes for almost a year.
That human touch is, I don't care who you are, everybody needs that. So
Scott is a resident of Albany County. She's over 70 and has an underlying health problem that puts her at high risk for serious illness if she were to contract COVID-19. Since December, when it was announced vaccines were going to be made available, she has eagerly been waiting for her turn.
We're obviously almost a month beyond the first of the year, and essentially had reached out on several fronts to try to find out the status in Albany County, and got a variety of reasons and situations explained to me as to why it was not available here.
Albany County is one of the few counties in the state that has not started offering vaccines to that 70 and over group and other frontline emergency personnel like funeral directors. Scott says it has been frustrating not being able to find information on the progress. Even we were not able to find out the status of Albany County vaccines. The longer Scott waits, the more uncomfortable she is.
How long can you roll the dice at over 70 years of age and hope that you don't get COVID when there is something to help you prevent that situation from occurring?
Scott isn't alone. Many Wyomingites over 70 are refreshing their county health department websites daily, trying to figure out when they will be eligible. Park County Public Health Officer Dr. Aaron Billen says spots for those who are 70 and over and the rest of the second priority group filled up quickly.
And within 2 days, all the vaccine clinics filled up, and we have to get more vaccines to be able to schedule more vaccine clinics.
And that's the problem. Wyoming is not receiving enough vaccines to meet the demand. This isn't just a Wyoming problem. The entire country is dealing with this. Laramie County Public Health Officer Dr. Stan Hartman hopes the new administration will fix things.
The allocations are based on state population. We're hoping that the incoming administration will be able to get production ramped up and get more vaccine out to all the states, not just Wyoming.
Laramie County is booked for vaccinations all the way through the end of March. And Hartman says he's not sure when they will be able to open up to the priority group after that. When Natrona County opened up to the second priority group, phone lines were exploding. Natrona County saw underwhelming interest when dealing with the first priority group. Haley Bloom with Natrona County Health Department says things picked up when they got to the next round of vaccinations.
So I think that their uptake to the vaccine was not surprising just because we knew that they wanted this vaccine. They wanted a way of moving forward. They wanted to be protected.
Interestingly, Natrona County signups started to quiet down a little this past week.
So I don't know if there's a certain population that's just maybe waiting to get it or, isn't ready to get it right now. I mean, you think about that population and there's a lot of snowbirds too. So are people gone? Or, you know, it's a lot of different factors.
But this has opened up an opportunity for people like Susie Scott.
And an acquaintance of mine, quite by accident, found out that Natrona County had additional vaccines.
So she called them up.
I said to her, I live in Albany County. And she said, oh, that's not a problem. She said, I have people driving from Teton County to get their vaccines here. I want to live to be a ripe old age, and I'm going to get my vaccination.
The State Department of Health says they recommend people to get vaccinated in their own county. And Natrona County Public Health Officer Dr. Mark Dowell says until more vaccines are shipped to Wyoming, people should be respectful.
We want people to stay in their own counties and get their vaccines there. That's the whole goal. We're not blocking people. We're not being mean. It doesn't help anybody when people are doing that and taking it away from people that live in that individual county.
But not all counties are administrating the vaccine the same way. So they may try to go elsewhere until their local health departments are able to meet their needs. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
When we come back, we will look at issues surrounding food insecurity during the pandemic. This is Open Spaces.
In part 8 of the Modern West, we travel to two towns where descendants of enslaved people came as they followed the American dream westward.
There were racial tensions, and whenever something would disappear, the black families would be accused right away of stealing.
The tale of two towns and what they can teach today's small towns. Find the Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. During the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of people are experiencing food insecurity. The Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vincent visited a food bank for a look at the rising need in our region.
I'm standing inside the warehouse of the food bank for Larimer County in northern Colorado. It looks like a factory assembly line with people preparing and packing provisions for when the doors open in an hour.
Cookies, protein bars, coffee.
That's Ruben Mattes. He's filling bags with delicious and vital items. Every year, he travels to volunteer with the Red Cross and help with disaster relief. This year, he thought he was needed close to home. He started volunteering at the onset of the pandemic.
Just like to help, you know? I'm retired from the Army. I put in 20 years.
One look outside the warehouse and the need for volunteers like Mattes becomes clear. It's a scene playing out all over the country. A long line of cars snakes around the building. People have been waiting for at least a couple hours for the drive-up distribution to start. Amy Pisani runs the food bank. She says there's been a stunning rise in demand.
We have literally doubled the number of individuals that we're serving in this drive-up distribution between March and November.
You heard that right. They've seen a 100% increase in need. Today, they'll likely serve roughly 600 families in a matter of 5 hours. This food bank is part of the Feeding America Network. The national nonprofit says that amid the pandemic, 1 in 6 adults and 1 in 4 children are likely to face food insecurity.
Hi, how you doing today?
Pretty good,
Well. It's now 10 a.m. and staff members are standing outside in the cold to check in motorists. Right now, drivers wait roughly 30 minutes to pull up to the finish line where they receive food. Barb Landeck rolls down her window to chat with me here. In recent months, she started leaning on the food bank for the first time.
I am a substitute teacher and there are no substitute jobs, so I have not had a job since March. And the food bank has been my lifeline.
Around the corner, Cindy Gates sits in an SUV with her son. She had to stop working as a nursing assistant because she lives with high-risk family members.
The pandemic's made it very difficult, you know, and there's no resources out there for a lot of people other than the food bank. It's like, you don't want to do it because you keep thinking other people need it and other people are needier than you, but then you reach this point, it's like, I have to.
A few cars ahead, Kyle Gomez is waiting to pick up food for his 82-year-old mother. He's a caretaker for her. Before the pandemic, he also worked in landscaping. At that time, he was visiting the food bank once a month. Now he's here weekly.
If it wasn't for the food bank, I'm not kidding you, the food bank and, you know, some people helping, and she gets some food stamps, and that's helped us a lot. So we're managing to get by, but, you know, I feel sorry for some people that have kids and big families.
One of those big families is waiting in a minivan. Carla Espinoza is here with her mother. She says she didn't start visiting the food bank until her parents lost work due to the pandemic. Now she's here.
Every 2 weeks, really.
So you get food for your parents, and do you have siblings as well?
Yes, we have two younger ones and my older sister, and I have a baby.
The food bank's Paul Donnelly overhears me talking to some of his clients and makes an important point.
This represents the folks that are able to get out, have transportation. There's a whole subset of folks who can't get out, don't have transportation, that sort of thing.
So the food bank started taking on deliveries. They partnered with Colorado State University when classes weren't in session. When school resumed, the food bank built their own system. Donnelly stresses the service is limited to roughly 500 deliveries a month.
And that's a lot for the food bank, which is not built for delivery. We're built for distribution like we're seeing here today.
In other words, it's hard to meet the full need right now. And food bank staff say that need will persist long after all the vaccines have gone out. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Robin Vincent.
On the Wind River Reservation, it's hard to get things like fresh vegetables, and lack of access to good food is a contributor to the fact that Native Americans on the reservation have a life expectancy 20 years shorter than non-Indigenous people in the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner found out how some are looking for solutions to the problem.
In 2016, 23% of Native Americans on the Wind River Reservation said they did not have adequate funds for food. That same year, a community-based research project called Growing Resilience received a grant to do research on food insecurity. It funds gardens on the Wind River Indian Reservation. Researchers are studying how growing your own fruits and vegetables can help combat food insecurity. Christine Porter is a professor at the University of Wyoming and lead researcher on the project.
I think it would be hard for a place to have a higher food insecurity rate than we found within these families.
She said that food insecurity is a problem everywhere, but there was a lack of data about Wind River specifically. Northern Arapaho tribal member Melvin Arthur is a researcher at the University of Wyoming on the project. Arthur says that the project combines data from biometrics with storytelling.
We did 100 home gardens and we reached almost 400 tribal members, both Shoshone and Arapaho. And through that project, I started interviews. First, I started with talking circles to interview the gardeners and get them to tell us, you know, what their experience was like.
Arthur developed a technique that he calls sovereign storytelling while conducting the interviews.
And what that did is it gave the participant the opportunity to tell their story however they wanted to. We always come in and tell people, give them a set of questions to answer, surveys, and, you know, we formulate all these research paradigms where we don't really look and go and say, well, what would you like? How would you like to tell your story?
Arthur wanted to do something different. He instructed participants to submit anything from artwork their kids made to a conversation among other gardeners. While hard to put numbers on, Arthur felt it important to include how gardening makes you feel in the research. especially with how universities have a colonialistic relationship with researching Native people, Arthur said. The project is now on pause because of the COVID-19 pandemic, and researchers hope to reveal findings when it is safe to collect more samples. But for now, participants continue to share their stories in unique ways. Rubina Tillman is a resident on the Wind River Indian Reservation. Tillman participated in the project a few years ago and now has her own garden with a pumpkin patch. She gives out pumpkins during Halloween to the neighborhood kids.
The Growing Resilience program really provided me with a lot of training and hands-on learning. We learned how to do a compost bin, and they gave me some worms, and I started a compost bin.
Rubina recorded highlights of her experience with Growing Resilience. Tillman was included in a video that Growing Resilience produced that wanted to emphasize the importance of storytelling and research about Native people. In the video, Tillman expresses how gardening makes her feel in slow, poetic tones.
In the winter, I'm still in the garden, adding manure from the horses and getting it ready for spring. I'm connected to the earth, to my husband, my four sons, and my daughter, to our horses and pigs, to my heritage, my language, my culture, and always to my garden.
Lead researcher Christine Porter says the project tries to quantify mental health, but that is difficult.
The only way to measure that really is through listening to people tell their stories.
The research hopes to continue in August of 2021. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
When we come back, we will bring you a reporting effort from our Mountain West News Bureau regarding policing in the region. This is Open Spaces.
Sometimes at the end of a long day, the best thing I know to do is totally escape into a really good story.
North Park has always been my healing place. Is this now a dangerous place?
He is really open, so I need to be open.
And that was when Oliver really started to show us what a talent he had.
I'm Erin Jones. Listen at humannaturepodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. 2020 will be known as a devastating year. More than 300,000 people in America died due to complications from the novel coronavirus. But it was the single death of a black man in Minneapolis that sparked nationwide protests against systemic racism and police brutality. It also sparked our Mountain West News Bureau to dig into the numbers of people killed in our region during interactions with law enforcement. And we found something startling. Our region has the highest rate of fatal encounters with police in the entire country. Today we bring you three segments in that series, Elevated Risk, as we take a hard look at law enforcement in the region. Nate Hedgie starts us off.
Last summer, parks and streets across the country filled with the sound of violins. They were played by people protesting the death of 23-year-old violinist Elijah McClain. The young black man was walking home from a convenience store when he was stopped by the police after someone called, saying he looked, quote, sketchy. After a tussle, police placed him in a chokehold and he lost consciousness.
Get some, give us more. Give us some more units. We're fighting him.
Relax. Just relax. Oh, man, it was Elijah McClain.
Yeah, McClain was 5'6", weighed 140 pounds, and he was a chronic asthmatic. And when he briefly regained consciousness, police claimed he had, quote, crazy strength. Paramedics on the scene gave him the powerful sedative ketamine. He had a cardiac arrest on the way to the hospital, and he died days later. McClain was just one of more than 1,100 people killed during interactions with police in the Mountain West since 2015. That's according to our analysis of data from the website Fatal Encounters. It counts these deaths by tracking media stories online.
It's all Google alerts.
That's founder and former Nevada journalist D. Brian Burghardt. He began tracking these cases nearly a decade ago after he had one of those aha moments.
I was driving home from work Friday night and I just saw this scene of chaos. Dozens of cop cars parked haphazardly, and I just got a feeling that either a cop had killed somebody or somebody had killed a cop.
And as a newspaper editor, this sparked his curiosity. How often do police kill civilians?
And it did not take me very long to figure out that nobody really knew.
The federal government does have a homicide database, but reporting those incidents is voluntary and many law enforcement agencies don't participate. So Burghardt eventually figured the best way to track this data was to gather stories from local media outlets. He estimates he missed a few cases.
But whatever we have is twice as good as anything that was ever released by the government.
According to the Mountain West News Bureau's analysis of that data, the fatal encounter rate in our region is more than 1.5 times the national average. There are a lot of theories as to why this is, but the most common one boils down to this.
Guns.
Guns.
The gun culture that's here.
It really is as simple as guns.
That's Burghardt, along with law enforcement experts Gabriel Schwartz, Robin Engel, and Justin Nix. They all say that in places where there's a high level of household gun ownership, there's also often a high level of people killed by police. Police officers are also more likely to be victims here. Justin Nix from the University of Nebraska, Omaha, explains.
Officers from day one are trained and socialized to anticipate danger and be prepared for any interaction to potentially go sideways and present a lethal threat to their own safety.
And we own more guns here than most anywhere else in the country. And Nix posits another idea, access to trauma centers after someone's shot.
It's just a little bit farther on average to trauma care, and minutes matter. And so when you're looking at data that only capture those deaths, it might lead you to believe that officers are using deadly force at a higher rate, when maybe they're using deadly force at similar rates and it's just people are dying at a higher rate.
And then there's this.
Something like 1 in 4 people shot and killed by police displayed signs of or were known to have a mental illness.
Many states in the Mountain West rank among the worst when it comes to the prevalence of mental illness and access to care. This includes Utah, where, in September, Golda Barton called 911.
So that's why we need a mental health worker. It's super important because he's sick.
Barton's 13-year-old autistic son was having a crisis. She warned that he might be carrying a BB or pellet gun. She wasn't sure. She also told the operator that her father had been shot by police last year, that her son saw it happen. Now he hated cops. When the police arrived, what occurred next was recorded on their body cameras.
We need him to go to the hospital. I need him to go to the hospital. I cannot get in there on my own.
The police found her son in the backyard, and he took off running. A chase ensued.
On the ground!
That's the officer shooting the boy 11 times.
Come on, Mama, love her.
Barton's son was wounded but survived. He was unarmed. Salt Lake City's mayor said in a statement soon after the shooting that she was, quote, heartbroken and frustrated by the incident. The family has filed suit against the Salt Lake City Police Department in U.S. District Court.
It's a bleak picture.
Gabriel Schwartz tracked police violence as a doctoral student at Harvard University. He says overall, the United States is a perfect storm of mental health issues, guns, inequality.
And police are much more often armed with guns and other military equipment.
He says many of the solutions posited by law enforcement, more body cameras, a more diverse police force, implicit bias training, on average, don't seem to work. Put all this together and...
it's a disaster.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
We know that people of color are at high risk for police violence. Data on indigenous people specifically, though, is difficult to come by. Still, the numbers we do have are alarming. Take Montana. Indigenous people there are 60% more likely than white people to be killed by the police. And that's likely an undercount. Savannah Marr reports on one victim of that statistic.
Cole Stump was a Montanan through and through.
He spent a lot of time breaking horses.
He was raised on the Rocky Boys Reservation in the north central part of the state.
He loved being a cowboy. He loved horses, so that was his go-to. If he could be around a horse, he would.
I'm on a video call with family members of the 29-year-old father of five and citizen of the Chippewa Cree tribe.
He was always laughing, teasing.
And he'd play dress up even with his girls.
He wore fingernail polish and makeup.
That laughter is Tashina Duran's. In the 3 months since her brother was shot and killed by the Billings police, she's been trying to piece together what happened.
I've been in contact with the county attorney's office, the Billings PD records department, the detective from Billings PD.
But those agencies say they can't share much information while the case is under investigation.
They just stonewall. They don't ever want to release anything.
Here's what we do know. Cole Stump was staying with a friend at an apartment complex in Billings in the weeks before his death. He was working under the hood of a car in the parking area when four police officers arrived, responding to a call from one of the apartment residents reporting suspicious activity. Here's Billings Police Chief Rich St. John speaking to reporters the next day.
And when the officers attempted to detain, question, and pat him down for weapons and put him in handcuffs for safety purposes, he refused to cooperate and comply.
It's not clear why they were detaining him. Chief St. John says they were able to get him face down on the ground, but there was a struggle. He said Stump pulled out a semi-automatic handgun from his waistband and pointed it at the officers.
Officers disengaged and two fired multiple rounds, striking the man.
Duran isn't convinced.
My brother's not a very big guy. How were they not able to subdue him? You know, how do they not have the de-escalation techniques to stop this?
Harlan Baker, chairman of the Chippewa Cree tribe, is also skeptical. He wrote a letter to the Montana Attorney General saying, quote, Billings police officers appear to continually inflict injury out of anger rather than the need to protect public safety when it comes to Indigenous people. For Melanie Yazzie, that description rings true.
The purpose of this violence is to reinforce the settler order.
Yazzie is Navajo and a professor of Native American studies at the University of New Mexico. She studies reservation border towns like Billings, and she says many of them sprung up as military and trading outposts when the United States was colonizing the West.
They were engaged in Indian wars, right? They were engaged in incredibly violent warfare against Native people.
Fast forward 150 years or so, and Yazzie says these towns are still hotbeds of resentment, hostility, and violence towards Indigenous people.
We're not supposed to be off the reservation. You know, we're supposed to be like in our place. And the moment that you stop doing that, you immediately become a threat, and then you need to be policed.
I won't sit here and tell you that officers don't get frustrated dealing with people and make bad decisions.
That's Lieutenant Brandon Woolley with the Billings Police Department.
To say that they do it specifically to a racial group, I don't believe that that's occurring.
Still, the department's own data shows Indigenous people are overrepresented in its arrests, use of force incidents, and officer-involved shootings. But Woolley says they're also more likely to be victims of crime in Billings, and that all these things are connected.
We have to talk about this substance abuse. We have to talk about the mental health issues. We have to talk about the education rates. We have to talk about the poverty. That's the social stuff, right? That when it breaks down, leads to interaction with law enforcement.
He says that social stuff is a symptom of historical trauma in tribal communities, something he says law enforcement has no control over and isn't equipped to address. It's that sentiment that's driven a movement across the U.S. to redirect funding away from police departments and into social programs. But Woolley says cutting police funding in border towns would be a mistake.
When we get to the bottom of this conversation, the Native American culture doesn't need less policing. They truly need more policing.
Angeline Cheek resents that comment.
With a statement like that, it's no wonder why our Indigenous people are being killed at such high rates.
Cheek is an Indigenous justice organizer with the ACLU of Montana and a citizen of the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes. She says we can't police our way out of this problem.
We don't need more policing. We need equitable distribution of resources and the recognition of long-standing treaty rights.
Tashina Duran is planning a march through Billings to honor her brother's life. Whatever happened between him and the police, she says his story shouldn't be swept under the rug.
It seems like being Native that they consider us disposable. So shooting one more, what's that, you know? No one cares. No one seems to care.
The Billings Police Department and the Yellowstone County Attorney are currently wrapping up their investigation into Stump's death. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Savannah Marr.
Just like most of us, police want people to understand their perspective. And if they see a problem, they want to be part of the solution. Sometimes that involves leaving the force and looking at policing from the outside. As part of our series Elevated Risk, Police Violence in the Mountain West, Madeline Beck talked with some of those former officers to get their insights.
Until recently, Logan Daly was a deputy sheriff in rural Cherry County, Nebraska. Today, he's the managing editor and reporter for 5 publications based in Wyoming.
I would say both are noble professions. I mean, they're both, in my opinion, very important professions.
Daly loves his new job, but he says the media can poison how the public sees the police, even in rural areas. He remembers one experience he had as a cop.
There was a young man that lived in one of the towns where I used to patrol through, and I drove through one day, and he put his hands up, and I kind of chuckled, and I was like, what the heck? And so I stop, and I'm like, what are you doing? And he says, hands up, don't shoot. And this is like an 8-year-old. And so I ask him, I'm like, well, why are you doing that? He goes, well, I saw it on YouTube. And I was like, what did you see on YouTube? Well, cops kill people.
Daly was angry and upset. He hopes in his new role, he can foster better communication between the police, the media, and ultimately the community. He's finding some departments are more willing to talk than others, though. As a former police officer, he knows transparency can be tricky. He says officers are trained to protect people's privacy.
I don't want to break that trust, basically, that the public has in us.
And also, he says if they are seen as breaking that trust,
you're constantly concerned about being sued. Because, I mean, this is America. You can sue anybody for anything.
He says more training could help with that, letting police chiefs and officers know what they can and can't say under the law. But it's not just about transparency. He recognizes that there are bad apples, and they're not always dealt with.
I've encountered that, and I'm not saying this officer was going out and killing people. It was nothing like that. But he was overstepping his bounds. I would bring it up and say, hey, this is the issues, here's what I have, and then nothing would happen.
This focus on bad apples is misguided when we look at how to really improve the profession.
That's Paul Taylor. He's a former officer and officer trainer who now spends his time trying to figure out ways to make policing safer for both citizens and officers.
The current approach to how we look at, say, bad outcomes in policing really lends itself towards a liability focus for police organizations.
In other words, if something bad happens, it starts a criminal investigation. Officers involved don't say exactly what happened, fearing prosecution. Case details are sometimes sealed off.
That focus stunts the growth of the profession and really the ability to learn.
His research at the University of Colorado Denver includes how to minimize accidental shootings. He says that kind of research into policing is needed right now and isn't getting enough attention.
I call it the profession that science has left behind, because in a lot of areas, whether that be from the management perspective to how we look at improving outcomes, we're really stuck in this Tayloristic mindset that if we just tell people to do better, they will.
He says we need to analyze incidents of police violence the way we look at emergency room deaths or plane crashes.
There's 1,000 reasons a plane might crash. If we're only looking at the actions of the pilot and whether or not they were criminal, we would miss why the event occurred most of the time.
He says that system wouldn't just pin acts on individuals, but instead make it the responsibility of the entire profession to figure out how to avoid accidents or abuses of power in the future. Former cop and police psychologist Jack Digliani would add looking at the mental health of cops involved as well. He wants cops to ask for help before
their work product would degrade to the point where, they become dangerous to themselves, others, or their work product is so bad that they begin to encounter discipline.
Digliani says police officers face significant stress in their work, and there's a fallacy that asking for help is a sign of weakness. To counteract this, he's set up an entire 12-step initiative. It's being used by police officers around the nation to encourage every officer to monitor their mental well-being and to seek help if they need it. But he says there's still not enough focus on mental health.
Yes, we still, in fact, have not only a long way to go in departments that implement these programs, we also have many departments that have no support programs at all, if you can believe that, in the 21st century. But that is, in fact, the case.
He just says all officers should have a place to go, a person to talk to, and resources. Because he says policing will stick around in one form or another in any society without complete anarchy. So we need to figure out how to help officers help us. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
All of the segments from the five-part Elevated Risk series can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. When we come back, we bring you a couple of segments about the arts. This is Open Spaces.
One thing we're proud of here at Wyoming Public Media is our podcasts. Whether you're looking for a good story from human nature,
I was convinced some of them are going to die,
or you want to hear our region in unexpected ways through the Modern West.
When women teach women, we're saving relationships one cast at a time.
We've got a whole world waiting for you online. Explore under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. When an insurrection mob violently pushed through the entrance of the Capitol building in early January, the American Alliance of Museums issued a statement condemning the violence that occurred. They did so because the Capitol is more than a workplace. It's a living museum. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao talks to University of Wyoming Art Museum Director Nicole Crawford about her first impression on January 6th.
I think my initial reaction was, shock and fear. The Capitol is right on the National Mall and all the museums are right there. So if it's starting there, the fear of things spreading, any sort of violence can turn into, vandalism, and you just don't know what the potential of that might be. And I think that was the scariest part, is unknown for that whole area, and what that means for the museums there.
I didn't think of the Capitol as a museum and sort of like a keeper of culture in a sense. How would you sort of explain to folks that don't really understand or is not aware that the Capitol is more than just a workspace?
Well, first thing you think about is the art and the artifacts and the objects and the building itself, because the building is a historical building, and so we should think of it as a museum, or even as its own object in a way, because it has such a history. So, when people are coming into a space in an unregulated way, you always worry about what happens to the artwork, the paintings, the sculptures. If you've ever been there, you can see the paintings are very large, so the idea that somebody was going to grab one of those big paintings off the wall and take it wasn't the biggest concern. It was probably more of a concern of things being damaged and destroyed. And these artworks and objects are irreplaceable. Think of past presidents lying in state there. I mean, the history is really rich, and it's such an American history. This building is, it's a symbol of what the United States is. You're not going to find this in any other country, right? It's the U.S. Capitol building. And it does have its own curators. So the artwork that's there is pretty significant. Most people just think of it, as you said, as a place where a place of work and business and where things happen. But it is a keeper of American culture.
What are some things that you saw from the mob that you were sort of shocked and also a bit alarmed and worried, especially related to the artifacts? Because I know there were some pictures of a glass frame that was broken on the floor. Based off of that, what were some of the images and the scenes that struck you and you were like, oh my God, that's a sin?
Well, in museums, we always have disaster plans. That's just part of who we are, because we are, the keepers of culture and history. So we always have that in mind. And I think for me, as soon as I see something breaking, especially windows breaking, it's alarming, because that can continue on inside the building and with the artifacts and objects and sculptures. So I think that's the most alarming point, is once it escalates that far. We don't have disaster plans for this. Usually it's for earthquakes or fire or water damage. So, you know, maybe this is something new we're going to write into our new disaster plans in the museum field.
You know, the American Alliance of Museums put out a statement on the violence at the U.S. Capitol. And why do you think it is important for museums to respond this way?
Museums, you know, we're really a close-knit community and we really take care of our own. And it's up to us to help each other out. Just the fact that you mentioned you didn't even think of the museum or the Capitol as a museum. So it's important for other museums to step in and, one, remind people that, you know, buildings like this are historic and should be thought of as museums. And two, you know, museums have that knowledge to help other museums out.
Why is it very important for museums to exist everywhere globally and for people to consider it as important?
You know, museums are important because we are the keepers of culture. We have culture and history because, you know, we have the objects that are really old and we can care for them. Early civilization, we have those objects and we can learn from those. Museums are an important spot for learning and education and not forgetting the past and even looking to the future. If you go to an art museum and you see contemporary art, you might get a more understanding about current times and what's happening now, or maybe it'll help you reflect on the past and how that affects how you live your life today.
That was UW Art Museum Director Nicole Crawford talking to Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao. In 2018, the UCross Artist Residency Program in Northern Wyoming hosted its first fellows for its Native American Fellowship for Visual Arts to have the space and time to focus solely on their art. This past fall, the program extended the opportunity to its first Native American Writing Fellow. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with Diné writer and teacher Brendan Basham about his forthcoming debut novel.
What was the residency like for you? You know, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do when you first got there? And did it change? Or did you kind of come in with, you know, not really having a strict idea?
When I got there, I had so many ideas. I had too many ideas, really. I wanted to write some essays. I have some poetry, short stories that are unfinished. But I just a few weeks before I arrived, I'd sent my agent the latest copy of my draft of my novel. So I wanted to put that aside and work on something brand new. And when I got there, I kind of went down a few different rabbit holes, where I was trying to study one thing or one character, and somehow that brought me to some mining corporations, because a lot of these private security firms work for mining corporations all over the world, and a lot of mining corporations do most of the work on indigenous lands, and they've done this for, you know, many, many, many years. And the more I looked into that, I ended up going back to the reservation, back to the Navajo Reservation where my family is from, and researching not only the coal mining industry there from Peabody Mines, but also the uranium mining corporations. I had no idea that I was going to end up in that place when I arrived. So that's the kind of beautiful thing about UCross.
What really first brought you into writing? Like, what made you want to pursue it as a career?
I think I've always wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a writer since I was in grade school, I think. I got my first couple of poems published in a little plastic spiral-bound portfolio in Flagstaff for the school district. And they published some crappy little poems of mine. But my entire life, everyone said, oh, you're never going to make a living. You're never, you know, this, you have to find some kind of a backup position. So, you know, I learned how to cook. I taught myself how to cook to get myself through college. And I ended up being really good at it, and I ended up being a fairly decent boss until it wore me down, and I became one of those bosses that I hated. And at that point, I missed writing so much. I knew that I was kind of missing a part of myself and on many very real levels and artistic levels. But, you know, after my brother died, I think I really wanted to focus more on my writing. And, you know, ultimately, he became that spark for my first novel.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit about what your first novel is about?
So it's called Swim Home to the Vanished. And I guess it's about a man who loses someone really close to him. And in the case, it's his brother. And in that grief, his body changes and demands a new way to breathe. And so he, like, goes on this journey to kind of acknowledge his loss, but also to confront that loss. And he finds himself in a strange fishing village full of characters who are also grieving. And I call it transmuting. They're transmuting. They're kind of, they're changing. That process of grieving changes them, not only mentally but physically. So that they're also grieving and transmuting, and have been for generations. Kind of like how Native Americans in this country are kind of still grieving and living with heavy loss. So it's multi-layered grief, and I laugh about it now, but it's a very real thing. Very true.
Yeah, that sounds like such a good read. You know, are there any other additional themes that you're really interested in exploring in your work?
I think what keeps calling back to me is, since I can't really be on the Neta, on the reservation, the Navajo Nation right now, I think it's kind of my duty in some way to write about that land and write about my family. And that history, but not just the history that we know about the reservation, but like Indians now, modern Indians and how they're living, and dealing with, for me, it is a sense of guilt for sure. Guilt that I don't really know my language fully enough to have a conversation with my elders, or that I'm not working, directly with my peers and at the college level or at the Indian school level, really helping Native kids become storytellers and become, educators in their own right. And we always think of, a Native existence as being pretty destitute, I guess, and I'm teaching a Native American literature class right now, and many of these students don't even realize that we're still alive. And if they do, they think that we're just living in poverty on these reservations. But there's a lot more to it than that. There's a lot more life, there's a lot more creativity. There's a lot more belief in who we are, the people. There's pride there. So anyway, I'm trying to always think of ways to give back somehow in that way.
Brendan Basham is the first writer to receive the UCross Native American Fellowship. Thanks, Brendan, for taking the time to talk.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire program and individual segments will be archived on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Shows also available wherever you get your podcasts, and individual segments can be found on the Wyoming Public Radio and Media Facebook page. Anna Rader is our digital editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.